Right. So if you've watched, well, pretty much any movie or TV show in the last 20 years, you know this face. You absolutely know this face. There's this distinctive presence, right? This mix of like neurotic energy, but also this really surprising vulnerability.
Yeah, totally.
You know, her delivery, that sort of wry smile, the energy she brings, doesn't matter if she's playing the quirky best friend or, you know, the exasperated wife or that super competent but slightly stressed out professional just trying to keep it together.
Right, she's everywhere.
But here's the thing. If I asked you, like, what's her one most recognizable performance? You might actually pause for a second.
You might struggle, yeah.
Simply because there are just so many to choose from.
And that struggle right there, that kind of is the whole professional story of Judith Therese Evans, who we all know as Judy Greer. She is maybe the ultimate, like, indispensable utility player in Hollywood. So our mission today, what we're doing here, is a real deep dive. We've got this huge stack of sources looking at her prolific, I mean, almost relentless career. It really is
And we
relentless.
want to move past that label, you know, the co-star label, which can sometimes feel a bit dismissive,
A little bit, yeah.
to really appreciate the sheer scope and maybe more importantly, the sort of strategic versatility of what she does.
Yeah, versatility is the key word. We've got sources covering, well, everything. Her early stuff, those dark comedies like Jawbreaker, indie dramas, then her incredible run-in, like prestige
Miss
films.
Attendance, yeah.
Right. And then what I find fascinating, her indispensable role in not one, not two, but like four massive global movie
It's kind of
franchises.
mind-blowing when you list them out.
So we want to understand, like, the architecture of a career that seems built not on this huge ego or needing to be the lead, but just consistent quality.
Exactly. Delivering every single time.
So we're going to chart her professional life, look at it chronologically. We'll highlight those really nuanced roles and how critics kept pointing out her dramatic chops, you know, even when she was in roles that felt way shorter than she probably deserved. It's really a study in maximizing impact, isn't it? Like, how much can you do with just a few scenes? Her whole career is just a testament to consistency, amazing comedic timing, obviously, but also this ability to ground things, even when the situation is completely absurd.
Really grounds it.
But, you know, before she was stealing scenes in blockbusters and on streaming, the roots of this very unique persona were planted firmly back in the Midwest.
Okay, let's start right at the beginning. She was born Judith Therese Evans, July 20th, 1975, in Detroit, Michigan. And the name change, right? Evans to Greer, that itself actually tells you a lot about her pragmatic approach to the business, like right from the start.
It absolutely does. She took the stage name Greer, that was her mother's maiden name, Molly Ann Greer, for a reason that's almost like anti-glamour. It's purely practical. We're told in these early interviews that there were simply, and this is the quote, several other actresses named Judy or Judy Evans already working. So this wasn't some, you know, dramatic reinvention to create a star persona. It was just a practical choice so she'd get the right audition calls. It really says a lot about that sort of no-nonsense, hardworking vibe that would define her as, you know, the ultimate character actor.
And her mom, Molly Ann, you mentioned her. The sources give us probably one of the most delightful background stories we have. So her mother was a hospital administrator, but before that, she was a nun for 8 years.
8 years, yeah. And the story of why that career ended is like the perfect origin story for Judy Greer's own sort of subtly subversive comedy style.
Okay, tell me.
She was apparently kicked out of the convent after 8 years. The reason? Wild behavior.
Wild behavior in a convent. What does that even mean?
Well, the specific detail they mention is fantastic. It involved owning a red bathing suit.
A red bathing suit. Okay, that is amazing. That kind of detail just immediately grounds her, doesn't it? This idea of someone slightly rebellious, but still, you know, highly competent, just kind of pushing against the rules.
Totally. And then her father, Rich Evans, he provided the contrast, right? The grounded engineering mind. He was a mechanical engineer.
So you've got this mix. Raised Roman Catholic in Redford Township and Livonia, Michigan, but there's this like undeniable streak of nonconformity, this quiet rebellion kind of running through the family history.
It sets up her whole persona perfectly, right? Someone who seems stable, maybe a little ordinary on the surface, but is holding all this delightful chaos just underneath.
But she didn't approach the acting part chaotically at all. Her training, that was formal, serious business.
Oh, absolutely. She went to Churchill High School, was in their creative and performing arts program, so she got an early start. But then, crucially, she graduates from the theater school at DePaul University in 1997. got her Bachelor of Fine Arts, a BFA.
And that BFA background, that's important, isn't it?
It's so important because it explains why she can handle, you know, serious drama and then turn around and do highly technical motion capture work with the same kind of ease that she handles. Like rapid-fire sitcom lines. She's properly trained for everything.
The sources show her career kicking off pretty much immediately, late 90s.
Yeah, her film debut was like a tiny role in a low-budget horror movie shot in Chicago, Stricken, back in 98. Then a small drama. But the real launch, the first role that really announced her specific thing, was 1999, Fern Mayo in Jawbreaker.
Oh, Fern Mayo, yes. That is such a defining late 90s role, especially for that kind of like pitch black comedy. She's the nerdy, totally overlooked teenager who gets sucked into this like popular girl murder cover-up. What was the significance of that role for her then?
Oh, it was huge. Black comedy needs such a specific tone, right? Like high stakes, but super dry delivery. And you get a switch between real emotion and total absurdity on a dime.
Yeah.
Fern Mayo let her show all of that. She wasn't just like the comic relief. She was kind of the conscience of the film and the catalyst for the whole plot. It proved she could carry serious narrative weight, even while playing the ultimate outsider.
And then right after Jawbreaker, she gets slotted into those, you know, typical early 2000s rom-com supporting roles, the best friend.
Yep. Like in What Women Want in 2000. The Wedding Planner in 2001. Mm. Standard stuff for rising comedic actors then.
We also have that amazing bit of TV trivia. She was cast in a rejected NBC pilot in 2002 with Stephen Colbert playing his sister.
Can you imagine? A pilot rejection is like a rite of passage, sure, but just picturing her and Colbert bouncing off each other. That's a glimpse of some serious comedy potential right there.
Totally. And that leads us kind of inevitably to the role that really cemented her as like a cult comedy favorite.
Has to be Kitty Sanchez, Arrested Development.
Yes, Kitty Sanchez. Say goodbye to these. She recurred across the original three seasons, right? Only 10 episodes total, but
yeah.
Wow, what's the lasting impact there? Why was that the role she was apparently most recognized for back in like 2009?
Well, a couple of things. First, it obviously speaks to just how huge Arrested Development became culturally. But more than that, Kitty Sanchez is just a masterclass in making a small supporting character completely unforgettable.
Totally unforgettable.
She's arrogant. She's terrible at her job. She flashes people constantly while yelling, "Say goodbye to these." That line became this huge meme. It was just pure, unhinged chaos, but delivered with, like, perfect timing. It showed that if you gave her a really specific, weird character, she could just blow it up, make it larger than life. Guaranteed people would remember her, even with not much screen time. So by 2004, Judy Greer isn't just promising anymore. She's pretty much Hollywood's go-to character actress. This next stretch, say 2004 to 2010, it's all about her just constantly, almost dizzyingly jumping between genres. And her commercial success starts really picking up.
Yeah, that commercial wave kicks off big time with 13. Going on 30 in 2004, I mean, that movie became an instant classic for a whole generation.
Absolutely. She played Lucy, right? The sort of slightly shady editor colleague of Jennifer Garner's character. Mm. And the film was huge, $96.5 million worldwide.
Right.
What's interesting is she's not just the supportive best friend here. She's the foil.
Right, the rival.
Kind of the person who represents that jaded corporate adult life that Jenna Garner's character is initially drawn to but then rejects. It shows she could play a bit meaner, a bit more cynical, which adds another layer to her comedy.
And then, like, immediately after cementing that rom-com success, she dives right into serious genre stuff, same year.
Yeah, she pops up in M. Night Shyamalan's The Village, massive thriller hit, made over $256 million globally. Then the next year, 2005, she plays a female werewolf in Wes Craven's horror movie Cursed.
Okay, Cursed didn't exactly set the world on fire, did it?
No, Cursed was famously troubled, widely panned, didn't make money. But the choice is interesting, this rapid shift. It doesn't feel accidental. It feels like she's actively trying not to get typecast.
Right.
Always testing herself, you know, taking on different technical challenges, even if the movie itself doesn't quite land.
That's a pattern you see a lot with strong character actors, right? They'll prioritize working with an interesting director or trying complex material, even if the final product is a bit messy. But the proof that critics were really starting to see her dramatic potential came in the smaller indie films.
You must be thinking of the post-9/11 drama, The Great New Wonderful from 2005.
That's the one. She plays a woman whose marriage is really struggling in the aftermath of the attacks. And this was a completely different Judy Greer, like raw, dramatic, really emotionally fragile.
And the critics noticed. The Boston Globe called the film an actor's playpen, which is a great description, but they singled her out specifically. They said she tears into this part as if it were prime rib.
Wow, prime rib. That's vivid.
It suggests she was just starved for that kind of meaty, dramatic material and just went for it. Showed everyone what she could do.
And that kind of critical praise for her dramatic work, even in indies, must have helped cement her reputation, right? Which probably helped her land consistent work in the very structured world of network TV, especially with someone like Chuck Lorre.
Yeah, she basically became a recurring player in the Chuck Lorre universe, appeared across multiple huge sitcoms, Two and a Half Men for years, The Big Bang Theory in 2010, later on Mom.
Mm-hmm.
It just shows she was the absolute go-to if you needed someone reliably sharp, reliably funny, who could just nail a character instantly. The definition of a pro comic actor.
She did try for a lead role, though, right? Briefly.
She did, yeah. A rare lead role for her back then was the ABC sitcom Misguided in 2008. She played a guidance counselor. It only lasted one season, got canceled pretty quick. And this is maybe the first hint of that kind of paradox we need to talk about with her career.
What paradox?
Why is she so brilliantly successful as the key supporting player, the secret weapon, but sometimes struggled when she was the central figure, especially early on? Was it the writing on that show, the network's expectations? Or was Hollywood just not quite sure how to package her unique, quirky energy as a traditional lead back then?
That's a really interesting question, and it gets even more interesting when you think about her longest-running TV role, maybe her most chaotic, which started in 2009. Her voice work, Cheryl Tunt in Archer.
Oh my God, Cheryl Tunt. Or Carol, or Charlene, depending on what kind of madness was happening that season.
Right.
That role lasted until 2023. For 14 years, she voiced this incredibly wealthy, totally chaotic, occasionally pyromaniac, deeply unstable secretary. And this isn't just like reading lines. It's full immersion into this absurd, often just screaming character.
It totally leverages that signature voice critics talk about, that fast-talking, high-comforting voice, but pushes it to, like, the absolute extreme. What makes Cheryl so significant compared to her live-action stuff?
Well, think about it. In live-action, Judy Greer often plays the reactor, the person reacting to the chaos, maybe the grounded center or the slightly exasperated observer.
Yeah, that makes sense.
In Archer, she is the chaos. It let her build this huge comedic persona completely separate from her physical presence. It proved her timing and her delivery alone are just a comic engine. And having that sustained long-term outlet for pure unhinged comedy feels like a really important part of her overall brand.
Yeah, definitely. And then just to wrap up this sort of defining 2004-2010 era, she once again showed her dramatic strength, again in a small role, in a movie that kind of split critics, Peep World.
Right, Peep World, dark comedy. She played Laura Meyerowitz, pregnant wife, finds out her husband has a secret porn addiction that gets exposed. Mm. The movie itself got, you know, mixed to negative reviews overall.
Mm.
But the sources are crystal clear. Critics singled her out. Again, the New York Times, the New York Daily News, they both said she delivered the most genuine performance in the whole cast. Consistently the strongest dramatic anchor, even when she's surrounded by broader comedy or flawed material.
And she finished 2010 with another commercial hit, the rom-com drama Love and Other Drugs. So she's just effortlessly bouncing between critically praised indies and big market movies. It really sets the stage perfectly for her biggest dramatic moment yet.
Okay, so if that last decade established her as, like, Hollywood's most reliable go-to supporting actress, 2011 feels like the moment where the critics, the awards bodies, everyone finally had to acknowledge her as a serious dramatic force. And the breakthrough was huge. Alexander Payne's film, The Descendants.
This was absolutely pivotal. You know, film stars George Clooney deals with really heavy stuff. Grief, family secrets, betrayal. And Greer's role, okay, it's short on screen time.
Yeah, it's not huge. No, she plays Julie Spear, a woman who finds out her husband was having an affair with the comatose woman at the center of the story.
Yeah.
But her scene is structurally essential. It's the emotional core, really. She's the wronged party who has to confront Clooney's character.
And the praise was instant and really specific, right? It wasn't just, oh, she was good. Critics zeroed in on the emotional depth she packed into that short time.
That's the key. David Thompson in The New Republic just called her touching. Simple, but effective. But Philip Kemp, writing for Sight and Sound, really nailed it. He praised her for turning her few brief scenes into a moving portrayal of undeservedly broken trust.
Undeservedly broken trust. Wow.
Think about conveying that. Years of emotional history, the shock of discovery, grief, anger, all held back but visible in just a few minutes. It takes serious skill, that training and dramatic depth, to deliver that kind of intense, efficient, emotional punch.
And that performance finally got her tangible awards recognition, prestige level.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
She got nominated for a Screen Actors Guild Award for the ensemble cast, which is huge, and a Satellite Award nomination for Best Supporting Actress. This put her firmly in the conversation alongside, you know, A-list dramatic actors. Proved her range went way beyond just comedy.
What's amazing about that year, 2011, is the kind of double whammy recognition she got.
Yeah, it wasn't just The Descendants. She was also honored for her work in the Duplass Brothers indie comedy drama Jeff, Who Lives at Home. And for the combination of those two very different performances, she won the John Cassavetes Award at the Denver Film Festival.
The Cassavetes Award, that's a big deal for indie film spirit.
It is. And critically, she was the first female actor to receive that specific award. So it honored her versatility, her commitment to interesting independent projects, no matter the budget or genre, just really solidifying her artistic cred.
So with this new critical respect, this momentum, we see her start to experiment more professionally, right? Looking beyond just acting roles. She hit Broadway.
Yeah. 2012, she makes her Broadway debut. It was in a comedy called Dead Accounts alongside Katie Holmes. Now, the play itself didn't get great reviews. No. One critic even kind of dismissed her role, suggesting it felt more like a plot device than a fully fleshed out character. Mm-hmm. But the fact that she did it, stepped onto a Broadway stage live every night, shows her commitment to trying new things. She wasn't afraid of the risk. It shows she sees herself as a complete performer, not just a screen actor.
And this experimental phase continues, moving behind the camera and into writing. Around 2014, she directed a short film.
She did. Her directorial debut was a short for AOL called Quiet Time. And it wasn't just some random story. It was specifically about transcendental meditation, TM, as a way to deal with stress. Really, she was so into the technique herself, she personally pitched the idea to AOL.
Which connects right back to that pragmatic side of her we talked about.
Totally. And her reason for choosing TM in the first place is peak Judy Greer.
Okay, what was it?
She publicly endorsed it, said she chose TM because, quote, it seemed the easiest, and I liked that it wasn't religious in any way.
Huh. Seemed the easiest. Perfect.
It perfectly mirrors her whole approach, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Find the most efficient, non-dogmatic way to get things done, whether it's picking a stage name or finding stress relief.
And 2014 also brought her book, her literary debut, which just perfectly encapsulated her unique brand. The title alone, I don't know what you know me from, Confessions of a Co-Star.
That title is just genius, isn't it? It leans right into the core of her fame. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows her face, but maybe not the name or the specific role. And it frames her whole story through that lens of being the reliable supporting player. Mm. The book did well, got good reviews. Kirkus Reviews called her an engaging and witty storyteller who was unsparingly honest. It gave her a platform to offer this really unique, self-deprecating view of Hollywood that, frankly, most leading stars couldn't pull off genuinely.
And all the while, she's still turning in these standout performances in genre movies. She went back to horror, playing Miss Desjardins, the sympathetic gym teacher, in the Carrie remake in 2013.
Another great example of her elevating the material. Mm. You know, critics were mostly skeptical about that remake. Like, why are we doing this again?
Yeah, I remember that.
But her performance as Miss Desjardins was consistently singled out for praise. She provided that necessary emotional anchor, the concerned adult trying to step in. She was this vital point of empathy in a story that's mostly about supernatural horror. She was kind of the one character, besides Carrie herself, that you were really rooting for.
And 2014 also marked her first dive into really technical performance work, motion capture.
Yeah, she joins the Planet of the Apes franchise. She takes on the role of Cornelia, the female chimpanzee, Caesar's wife, in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Uh-huh.
Huge box office success, right? Over $700 million worldwide. And at the exact same time, she's starring in that FX comedy series Married, playing Lena Bowman. That show got praise specifically for the chemistry between her and Nat Faxon. Mm. So you have this incredible juxtaposition, huge mocap blockbuster, and this intimate kind of raw modern TV comedy. Just shows how incredibly broad her working range had become by then. Okay, so starting around 2015, this next phase is where Judy Greer really becomes like a certified global franchise powerhouse.
It
feels less about her needing to prove her dramatic chops anymore, she'd done that, and more about proving her absolute reliability within these enormous, complex movie machines.
She had that insane franchise doubleheader in 2015, right? two massive blockbusters hit the same year.
It's pretty incredible. First, he's in Jurassic World playing Karen Mitchell, the mother of the two young protagonists, Zach and Gray. That movie just exploded, made $1.67 billion worldwide.
Insane numbers.
Absolutely insane.
Then she slides right into the Marvel Cinematic Universe with Ant-Man. Yeah. She plays Maggie Lang, Scott Lang's ex-wife, mother to Cassie, also a huge hit. Over $500 million globally.
It really speaks to her utility, doesn't it? She's the actor that directors and producers trust to bring that necessary humanity, that relatability, maybe a touch of humor, to the core relationships in these movies that are otherwise dominated by CGI dinosaurs or shrinking superheroes.
Exactly. She's the reality check.
Yeah.
The grounded presence. And she became indispensable in those roles, kept coming back. She reprised Cornelia, the chimpanzee, in War for the Planet of the Apes in 2017. She came back as Maggie Lang in Ant-Man and the Wasp in 2018, and then even had that quick cameo in Guardians of the Galaxy Vol. 3 just recently in 2023.
Let's pause on the motion capture work for a sec, because that often gets overlooked, I think. For an actor like her, known for really precise facial comedy, those little eye rolls, the sharp dialogue delivery,
What's
the artistic challenge of playing Cornelia, the chimpanzee?
Oh, it's an enormous shift. The challenge is all about translation, right? So much of her comedy and drama relies on those subtle facial tics, the timing of a glance, the quick turn of her head, all the things that the mocap technology basically replaces with a digital rendering of a non-human face.
Right, it's all covered up.
So she has to translate all that human emotion, loyalty, fear, maternal instinct purely into physical performance. It becomes almost like nonverbal acting. She has to rely entirely on posture, movement, the sounds she makes. And the fact that those Apes movies were so critically successful means her emotional contribution as Cornelia successfully came through all that digital layering, that takes immense physical control and real dramatic clarity.
Meanwhile, she wasn't just content being in front of the camera, even in mocap suits. 2017, she directs her first feature film.
Yeah, the comedy drama, A Happening of Monumental Proportions. And her motivation for doing it was interesting. She said she wanted to explore this dynamic where adults act like kids and kids act like adults. She got big names in it, Allison Janney, Jennifer Garner.
How'd it do?
Critically. Hmm. Not great. It was pretty widely panned, unfortunately. But the attempt itself, stepping up to direct a feature, shows that continuous ambition, right, to shape the whole narrative, control the tone, not just deliver her lines perfectly.
Her next big franchise role took her back to horror, but this time into a really iconic series, the direct sequel to Halloween in 2018.
Oh, yeah. She was perfectly cast as Karen Nelson, the daughter of Jamie Lee Curtis's legendary Laurie Strode. And that movie was another massive record-breaking hit, $255 million worldwide on a relatively small budget. The role needed her to be more than just the daughter. You know, she had to become part of the fight herself.
And the sources point to one specific scene in that movie that got her a lot of praise.
Yes. The big climax scene where her character, Karen, kind of pretends to be weak, lures Michael Myers into a trap by playing the victim, and then shoots him.
Gotcha.
Exactly. It was hailed as one of the film's absolute highlights. And it's such a perfect crystallization of her specific strength, playing that seemingly vulnerable, maybe slightly eccentric woman, who is actually fiercely strategic and incredibly competent underneath. It's the ultimate subversion of the old horror trope. And she came back for the sequel, Halloween Kills, in 2021.
So despite all this franchise success, the question still kind of lingers. When would Hollywood really give her a shot as a consistent lead? That started to shift more on TV, didn't it?
That's where the industry finally seemed to catch up, yeah. In the Jim Carrey show Kidding, which ran from 2018 to 2020, she starred as his estranged ex-wife. Critics really noted her uniformly terrific performance there. She also got critical recognition, an HCA nomination, for playing the real-life prosecutor, Leah Askey, in the limited series The Thing About Pam in 2022.
But the real insight into her power as an actor maybe comes from her work on The First Lady in 2022, where she actually came in as a replacement actor.
This is the perfect example of her superpower, rescuing material. She took over the role of Nancy Hale, Betty Ford's confidant, and one critic flat out asserted that Greer almost single-handedly saved the series from being too preachy, too on the nose.
Wow, single-handedly.
Yeah. The critic said she was the only actor in the whole cast who was able to make the didactic, obvious dialogue sound natural and fun. Think about that. She can take writing that feels flat or instructional and just breathe real, relatable human life into it. That is the definition of an actor elevating the script.
And then finally, she got the role that critics felt she deserved for years, a really substantial lead in that Hulu comedy series reboot in 2022. She played Bree Marie Jensen, a former sitcom star making a comeback.
This felt like the moment. Critics adored her in it. They explicitly noted she finally had the chance to play a lead role that perfectly used her specific skills. You know, being both confident and anxious, fast-talking in her signature high, comforting voice, she really carried the emotional core in the comedy of that show.
And yet, despite all that universal praise for her, the show got canceled after just one season.
Yeah. Which brings us right back to that core paradox, doesn't it?
It does.
Why is it that when Judy Greer is the crucial supporting piece, the project is often a massive hit, critically acclaimed, makes tons of money? But when she's the name above the title, the project sometimes struggles to find its footing or longevity.
It raises fascinating questions about how Hollywood packages actors, right?
Totally. Is her greatest strength actually derived from the contrast she provides to the main lead, the Jennifer Garner, the George Clooney? Is the industry just so used to her being the perfect, quirky, grounding element that they find it hard to see her as the viable center of a project? Reboot seemed structurally perfect for her, but maybe the timing or the subject matter just didn't quite grab the audience that had grown accustomed to loving her in those short, punchy, unforgettable bursts. It kind of suggests that sometimes being the absolutely essential ingredient rather than the main dish might be a more difficult path in some ways, but ultimately maybe a more reliable long-term career strategy in Hollywood.
So we've traced this incredible, relentless professional journey, but the sources also give us some really key insights into her personal philosophy, the choices that kind of keep her grounded through all the chaos of this career.
Yeah, and a big anchor in her personal life seems to have arrived right around 2011. Which, interestingly, is the same year she had that huge critical breakthrough with The Descendants. That's when she married Deanie Johnson. He's an executive producer on Real Time with Bill Maher.
Right.
And with that marriage, she also became a stepmother to his two kids. So that seems to have provided this really necessary stability, a grounding family structure, right at the moment her professional life was hitting this peak of critical intensity.
We talked about her Catholic upbringing earlier, but her spiritual path seems to be one of very deliberate, independent choices. And it started hilariously early on.
It is the perfect Judy Greer story. Okay, so she said in 2014 she wasn't a practicing Catholic anymore. But the shift apparently started way back when she was 10 years old, in 1985. She somehow convinced her parents to let her switch churches and start attending a Presbyterian church instead.
Okay, what was her reasoning?
Her stated reason, the one she gave her parents, was that she felt she'd be closer to God there. Very earnest.
Uh-huh. But the reality, which she shared later, was a bit more pragmatic and entertaining.
The real reason, as she confessed later, she thought the boys were cuter at that church.
Ah, of course.
It's just the core of her public persona, isn't it? That ability to frame a very human, maybe slightly self-serving, funny motivation under this guise of something earnest or high-minded, it's exactly what makes her characters feel so instantly real and relatable.
And that same pragmatic streak, that desire for an easy, non-dogmatic solution, that also defined how she approached stress relief later on.
Absolutely. As an adult dealing with intense Hollywood pressure, she turned to transcendental meditation. TM. She told Glamour magazine she actually researched different kinds of meditation and specifically chose TM because, again, quote, it seemed the easiest and I liked that it wasn't religious in any way.
Seemed the easiest. Again, love it.
It's this consistent thread, right? This commitment to efficiency and independence. Choosing a stage name, choosing a church, choosing a meditation practice. She finds the quickest, most effective route to success or sanity without getting bogged down in unnecessary dogma.
Finally, we should probably touch on her civic engagement, too. It shows she implies that same focus and passion outside the entertainment world.
Yeah, it's an important context for who she is. She's a registered Democrat. And notably, she serves on the board of directors for Project Chimp.
Project Chimps.
Yeah, it's a sanctuary for chimpanzees who were formerly used in research labs. And given her deep involvement with the Planet of the Apes franchise, playing Cornelia, her dedication to the welfare of real-life primates, it adds this really profound, specific layer to her philanthropy. It feels like a genuine investment in a cause that really resonates with her professional life, too. Hashtag ouch tag outro.
So looking back over this just incredible body of work, what we've really traced here isn't just, you know, an actor's resume. It feels more like the blueprint for one of the most successful, durable, and genuinely respected careers in modern Hollywood. From that early subversive comic energy like Fern Mayo and Jawbreaker, or the pure chaos of Kitty Sanchez and Cheryl Tunt, she really quickly matured into this incredibly reliable, serious, dramatic anchor in films like The Descendants.
Yeah, and we really can't overstate her contribution to the blockbuster era. I mean, becoming the human heart, essentially, of four massive global franchises. You've got the really high-tech, physically demanding motion capture in Planet of the Apes, the superhero comedy of Ant-Man, the survival terror of a Jurassic World, and the dramatic action within the Halloween saga. She proves she is structurally essential, no matter the genre, grossing billions worldwide, often without needing that top billing.
It all comes back to that perfect title of her book, doesn't it? I Don't Know What You Know Me From, Confessions of a Co-Star. Even now, after more than 150 film and TV credits, directing, writing a book, getting all this critical acclaim, that title still kind of holds true for many people. It just perfectly encapsulates her life in that really unique, vital space in Hollywood. The reliable, essential character actor who absolutely defines the tone of whatever project she's in.
So maybe here's the thought we can leave you with, something that kind of builds on the complexity of her career that we've been talking about. In an industry that is so obsessed with the leading star, the name above the title, Judy Greer's career demonstrates that true artistic longevity and consistent critical praise often comes from mastering the art of being the perfect supporting element.
So what are the specific artistic pressures, the strategic demands placed on an actor who is consistently the best person in the room, the most reliable player, but who almost always has to yield the final spotlight? What does it actually take to maintain that level of reliability, that wit, that depth, and continually steal scenes when your name isn't the one marquee? And why is that role, arguably, maybe the most essential role in modern filmmaking?